This week on the Special Ed Strategist.
Of course, I always say that I feel like the field found me in a really interesting way. I never thought that I would work with children. My mom is a longtime special education teacher, and I vowed that I would never like sing the wheels on the bus to save my life. I would say, rule of thumb, look at it as regulation from the beginning, because then you're going to approach the student or the child and the situation from a completely different lens. And with older kids, you could frame it differently. I frame it as, because all my work is through play, I frame it as a play idea. And I say, let's figure out where this play idea comes from. And that's a hard question too, because it all comes from their mind. Or, which is also a really great part, it doesn't get resolved. And then I say, sometimes when there are problems, there is no solution. And then we go back to the discomfort where kids tell me, just give me the answer. Just give me the answer and make it go away.
Hello, and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Have you ever felt like your kiddo's behavior or misbehavior, whether that's in the classroom or your own personal kiddo, is actually something deeper? What if I told you that regulation, not discipline, is the key to unlocking growth? Today, I'm joined by Paulina, a trauma-certified speech-language pathologist, communication and feeding expert, and all-around powerhouse in the world of ADHD and autism support. In this episode, we're diving into why your kiddo may be struggling, how to support working memory, impulse control, and cognitive flexibility, and most importantly, how to move from frustration to connection. Trust me, you're not going to want to miss this one. So let's get started. Welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us, Paulina.
Thank you so much for having me. What a lovely introduction. I want to listen to it too.
Perfect. I love it. I love it. So for those that may be new to your work, can you introduce yourself and share kind of what has led you to this space and how your journey aligns with supporting special education and all that goes with it?
Of course, I always say that I feel like the field found me in a really interesting way. I never thought that I would work with children. My mom is a longtime special education teacher, and I vowed that I would never like sing the wheels on the bus to save my life. And yet I wound up in a similar field. I started actually really early on when I was just in college as a volunteer in a special education preschool. And then when I started to see that there were other avenues and other specialties, I went the language route. I never even knew that that type of profession existed. I knew that I was very good with words and that I enjoyed reading, and I didn't know what to do with that as a profession.
I love how you phrase that, the profession or the field found me. And I think that's true for a lot of us, right? I kind of fell into special education, although I knew I was going the teacher route. My undergrad is in general education, although it just propelled me into special education and kind of snowballed from there. But that makes it really fun for where you're headed and what we're going to talk about today. Before we dive in, can you just tell us one thing that you love to do, maybe a hobby, a pastime, a sport? It doesn't necessarily have to align with your known current profession, but something that gives us a little peek into the you behind your work.
So I weight train, and that's my regulation. That's really my zen moments when I know that I can pick up something really heavy, and it provides me with that clarity in the morning that I need to be able to start my day.
Yes. And it's so good. I have started to do some of that myself. And I do say that I get younger as the day goes on, meaning that I'm so tight, you know, everything in the morning. And then as I stretch and move, things start to feel a little younger, but it is really cool when you pick up a new weight that you haven't done before. It's just really empowering. I love it.
It is. And it gives me that it's just nothing for that hour, nothing else matters.
Yes, and you can't really think about work and life. You're just like focused on the in the moment, which I think is pretty cool.
And I think that goes into what we're going to talk about, especially what you mentioned, focusing on what's happening in this moment and what's needed for the moment.
Yes. All right. So let's do it. So let's start talking about reframing behavior and kind of getting an understanding of dysregulation. So many parents and educators can see misbehavior, but they don't necessarily see that as dysregulation. So, what are some of the biggest signs that a student, a child is actually struggling with regulation rather than acting out?
I would say, rule of thumb, look at it as regulation from the beginning, because then you're going to approach the student or the child and the situation from a completely different lens. And that's a very big perspective shift. And I definitely understand that. It also, as a professional, it took me a decade to get here. I was just fortunate. Again, we say that the field found me, and I was also fortunate enough because I was mentored in a specific way to use play and to look at each individual child from a relationship-based model. And that's what really drive the work. So when you're looking at a child who is struggling and who's having a really difficult time, everything on the outside, whether they're throwing a toy or they're throwing words your way, to understand that it's not personal. It's not a personal attack on you. Their nervous system is disrupted.
Yeah. So can you take a step back and help define regulation, dysregulation, and what that all means?
I think we have to go all the way back to co-regulation
Okay.
and where it even starts. And that's all the way back to infancy. And it's so important to understand that co-regulation isn't something that goes away. It's not a goal for us to diminish it because we all need co-regulators, even as adults. We need that person to go to who we don't even have to say anything to. We just show up and they show up for us. And we could sit in silence, we can cry, and that's co-regulation. Older adults call it venting. It's co-regulation. You're always going back to those moments in your childhood because the brain needs to figure out where and when it's safe. And that's what co-regulation provides. And in order for kids to slowly learn how to self-regulate, they need somebody to show up consistently for them, to give them those consistent cues, to be able to read theirs and know when to step in for support.
And that is such a gift that educators have. When I started in the field, I was in high school working with juvenile delinquents, self-contained setting. And I don't know that I had those words many, many years ago of what you're describing, but as you're doing saying it, I'm like, yeah, I became that for the students. I think you even said that relationship model where you're showing up, you're consistent, you're fair. And giving that space for a student that may come into your classroom or into your home that is dysregulated to then, and we'll talk about that, how to get them back online, so to say, so that they're feeling better and more confident in their body.
And that's also such a big question where it's, well, how long is this going to take? I usually get that question from parents and from educators. Like, we have a classroom to run. How long is this regulation thing going to take? Or how long do we allow for dysregulation to occur? And what I say is that you can't put a time span on it. There's no such thing of, well, how about you be quiet for 10 minutes and then I'll come back to you. The nervous system doesn't work that way.
Yeah, right. And a previous guest, Britt Rathbone, was on, and he and I were talking about similar concepts here, and that it's also important as either a parent or an educator to really educate the folks that are around you on what is happening with that child. And so if you have an IEP, an individualized education program, you could even put in there as training the teachers or training for the parents so that they can better understand it, because it's hard enough, you know, as a classroom educator, as a parent, and then you have somebody come as you're working on whatever that may be of helping that student kind of regulate. And then they come in and say something or do something because they think you're taking too long or it doesn't look like the way that they would want to do it. And that just makes everything explode and shatters that relationship that you've been working to build.
I'm so glad you keep coming back to the relationship, because part of understanding regulation is knowing that relationships are not conditional. The child isn't doing something for me so they can get something in return. And it's the same thing at home. It's the same thing in the classroom setting. So a relationship that's purely based on trust means that when somebody's having a really tough moment and that leads into another tough moment, it means that when they come back the next day, no one's holding it against them. No one's saying that, well, you didn't perform as expected yesterday, so now today, this is the consequence for it.
Right. Yes, 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 yes. And so with that, you know, and if you think about older students or even younger students, that if they are dysregulated and they've been struggling with this, their interactions with peers and adults may have then helped kind of continue to chip away at that. And so, kind of again, highlighting the importance of a relationship where a student feels safe, they feel heard, and that they have a choice and a say and some autonomy in this process, you know, from an education standpoint, or just even in the home, that they feel like they have some sort of validation.
Exactly. And that autonomy part actually comes from self-determination theory. And it's not just a theory. It's put into practice. It's also very, very poignant for the classroom, because it has three very specific pillars. And one of them is autonomy. And autonomy is looked at as maybe sometimes something negative, where it's, oh, you're just going to let the student or the kid do whatever they want. It's more about them having ownership, because then the question becomes, well, how do you have a student hold on to their own responsibility to really pull back and zoom out and let you know, in this argument that I had with another student, I can definitely see my role in it. It's not going to happen in the moment that that argument is going on. It's not. In order to actually develop that skill, it's really more about seeking the student's perspective. And I say that often too. It's not perspective taking, where immediately you tell the student who was, you know, air quotes, misbehaving, how would the other person feel? They're not in that space. They can't access those skills, because you're asking them to perform a very, very meta type of task, like going beyond what their capabilities are. And it's so important in that moment to go, I'm just wondering, what is going on for you? What's going on for you? Because I see a struggle here, and I'm really curious for you to tell me what it's like. It's openness, and it's an invitation to have a conversation instead of, and this is where the nuance in language comes in for parents and educators alike, instead of hitting a child with a why.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
like, it's sort of very brief pause there. Instead of hitting a child with, why would you do that? Why can't you figure out how that makes somebody else feel? Those kind of whys, they are really shame inducing, especially for neurodivergent kids.
And I'm sure it's not, this getting curious part is not a one and done, right? Again, back to the relationship, they, you know, and even if they have a strong relationship with that adult figure, it just may depend on the day too. So really giving space to that. And again, you know, understanding the big picture and little picture and what that means, and that constant, as you phrase it, zoom in and zoom out. And that's, you know, even when you're building an IEP or building a individualized approach for a student, it really is taking that bigger picture, where are we going and how are we going to support this kid? How are we scaffolding this and zooming in to then help identify those areas?
And then leaving some room for flexibility.
Yes.
Really, really leaving some room for flexibility because when, and I say this all the time, when adults are stuck in it has to be this way, and then we're expecting the kids to be flexible, we're not showing up as we expect a child to. And then it really becomes unfair. And I have a lot of kids who come in and they live in this world of unfairness, and that's where we need to meet them. That's where, going back to the regulation piece, we meet them in their world of unfairness. When they come in, they go, "This is really unfair." And the first thing I say is, "Absolutely. It
The
absolutely
validation, yeah.
is, because it's unfair for you. It
Yeah.
is. I am with you in the unfairness. Let's live here for a bit." And then, interestingly enough, they don't want to because it's uncomfortable.
I was just gonna say, then somebody's uncomfortable.
Then somebody's uncomfortable. And then I say, "This is fantastic. Let's live in discomfort. I'm in it. I'm in it with you." And it really depends on, going back to what a nervous system can handle, it depends on capacity. And it depends on the child's capacity and the adult's capacity. Teachers get burnt out, and so do kids. And I think it's really under-acknowledged how real burnout is for, I work with neurodivergent kids, for neurodivergent kids. You can see it. You could see it intensify. You could see it start to spiral out. And that's when they need the support the most. Not consequences the most, the support the most.
Exactly. And kiddos aren't waking up wanting to be a jerk. Like they're just not waking up that way, right? So there's a reason of what has got them into a place of discomfort and how we as adults can better support that. So we talked up, you had mentioned self-determination theory, and you said there's three pillars. Number one was autonomy.
Yes.
Would you mind sharing the other two?
Yeah, so the other one is connectedness. And it's also about, like, kids learn from people they like. And
Yeah, I mean, we do as
it has,
adults too, right? If you're
of
going to take a
course,
class, if
yes.
you have a boss, or you know, the sales clerk is curt or not hearing you, or any of these adjectives we could use to describe, you're not as open and relaxed to wanting to hear what someone has to say.
And then it's, and that connectedness has to do with going back to relationships. When kids feel like they are connected and have a relationship, then they will also be connected to the knowledge, because they'll be, the brain will quite literally be open to it. They'll be open to learning because then they have autonomy in their learning process. And they could start to advocate for themselves and let educators know, "So this is the what works for my brain. I know to you it looks different. This is the way that works for me. How do I know that?" Because, hopefully they have someone like myself who's helped them figure it out. It's so interesting. This conversation comes at such a perfect time because I also work with older teens, and a lot of them struggle. Yes, the social emotional piece, and of course the executive functioning aspect, which is huge. It doesn't just start in the teenage years. It starts at 6 months of age. These skills don't all of a sudden just form themselves. They are, like you mentioned, they are scaffolded, they are built. There are, 15 of them. And we're always finding that there's new terminology, and we could also relate it to new skills. Language is executive function based. Also, you can't just tell somebody to memorize words when they don't know where to put them or how to organize them. So, going back to that, like, teacher-student relationship, I was looking at the feedback that, like, one of my ADHD teens got on an English assignment, and the feedback said, "This does not have enough detail. It's too vague, -5." And I'm looking at this feedback and I'm saying, what is this? So first of all, it didn't mean anything to me. And then I showed it to my client and I said, what does this mean to you? And he goes, I have no idea. And I said, okay, well, this is interesting. Do you mind if I look at other feedback that you've gotten for your assignments? And it was the same feedback. This needs more detail, not enough information. This is too broad, needs more detail. And because it's the same feedback and he doesn't know what it means, how can he then perform in a way that the teacher expects? And then he thinks it's his fault.
Right.
He was like, I'm failing because it's about me. And I'm looking at his notebook and I said, buddy, look at all of this effort. You are working so hard. You're putting so much time and effort into figuring out this novel and taking these notes. And I go, I'm so sorry that it's not being recognized.
Yeah.
And then the parent is stuck and she goes, what do we do now?
And so what is the answer? What do we do now?
The answer is, I say, right now, you're his biggest advocate as the parent. I go, we're going to become the squeaky wheel. Not in a negative way, in a way to let the teacher know, I have a feeling that my son is going to benefit from feedback that's a little different. And then I go, I understand you have a big classroom to run. The feedback that you gave was 3 sentences long. Can you give feedback that's also 3 sentences long and instead tell him exactly what you were looking for? It's the same amount of time. It's the same amount of effort. And I say, just the pivot shift. Because the fact that he keeps giving you the same type of answers means that the feedback isn't landing on him in the way that maybe it lands for other students. And when we asked him, well, she's asking you for details. What's a detail? And he goes, who knows?
I don't know.
Yeah. He said, I have no idea what she's looking for. And he said, that's why I just write whatever comes to mind, hoping that somewhere in this paragraph, something works. And sometimes it does. And most of the time it doesn't, because there's no system. He's just putting it all. He goes, I'm just putting it all out there. Something has to stick. And that's what he's been doing. And it's really unfortunate because it goes back to the relationship. There isn't that solid relationship where he feels comfortable enough to go up to his teacher and say, I'm having a really hard time understanding.
Yes. And like, let's stay in that for a second, because there's a lot of times, even with our younger kiddos and students, very similar to this, they don't know what done looks like.
Yes.
What is the criteria for this? So I'm not understanding the feedback because I don't even understand what done looks like. And you can put that in as a parent perspective of cleaning a room, properly taking a shower and washing your hair, to things that are done in the school and also in the community. What does done look like? So having that shift and making sure that students and youth are understanding explicitly what we're trying to convey and teach really then does, I would imagine, play into that regulation component, right?
Absolutely. It absolutely does. And that's one of the biggest reasons I don't use timers in my sessions or anything having to do with time, because for ADHD kids, time doesn't mean anything. And some of the younger kids too have said, well, how long do we have left? And I always say, let's say I give you a number. What does that number mean to you? And they go, nothing. And you go, right. Okay. So then the question becomes, well, how do we work around developing a sense of time? And that's where it starts. So it does start at a younger age, and it can. And with older kids, you could frame it differently. I frame it as, because all my work is through play, I frame it as a play idea. And I say, let's figure out where this play idea comes from. And that's a hard question too, because it all comes from their mind. And when they come up with the idea, I always say, That sounds so interesting. How do we start? Executive function skill of task initiation. How do we start? And it's so interesting that the starting point is usually somewhere in the middle. For their brain, it's somewhere in the middle with minute detail that does not even matter. And to them, that's what their brain lands on. We start here. And I say, oh, so to me, and I always bring it back on myself. And that's something that I'm hoping educators take away from this also, that simple phrase of, to me, it sounds like this is what I'm noticing. And then again, it leaves an opening of what's going on for you. And especially important that I'm not telling kids how they're supposed to be feeling, what they're supposed to be experiencing, is that it's my take on what's going on for them. And because like this is my field and this is what I've been doing for over 15 years, in my mind, I'm going, I know I'm right. I know that this is what's going on for you. But the problem is that it's not about me being right. And that's such an important message that I would want for parents and educators to take away is that if you prioritize being right as the adult, then you're always going to prove the child wrong. And it's going to put a strain on your relationship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So before we get into kind of how play helps strengthen some areas, what is our third one? So we have autonomy and connectedness, and what's number three?
And it goes, it's the relationship.
Done. I love it. Yeah, and it's important to have that. So you've kind of
I
emphasized.
have one more. I'm going to
Yeah,
interrupt. I'm so
let's
sorry.
do
I have
it.
one more. It's confidence.
Competence.
It's feeling, I knew it was there in my mind. It's feeling confident in their own learning.
Yeah.
And then when you look at the three of them as intertwined, when one is missing, the others crumble. So they all three pieces have to come together. So, like, how confident do I feel when I am taking an exam? And I am confident because I advocated for my needs in terms of what do I need as a study guide, or what do I need in terms of like the kind of, we're talking about IEPs, the kind of space that I need to be in so that I am tuned into this test. And like, do I feel comfortable and connected enough to the person who's there in the room, whether for older kids, right? It's a proctor or like somebody they're familiar with. So I could let them know that I need to stand up and I need to walk around. Like, this is the way that I think and process information. I need to move away from this paper. And that way I could give you the answers instead of being like forced to just sit still, because then my brain is only tuned into keep your body still. And all this knowledge that I have, it now disappeared. And it's the same for a very young child and an older child. And I'm going to say it's also the same for an adult in the workforce. Like, we all want to feel some kind of autonomy. We want to be acknowledged that we are a competent employee, just like kids want to be acknowledged that they are competent students. And then that connectedness, where like people leave jobs because of the boss, because of the culture, and they go to other, and then people stay because they feel connected, because it's the relationship.
Yeah, it all comes down to that. It is so true. So you've emphasized that play is powerful, right? And it really helping with regulation. So can we talk about that a little bit in terms of how does play help strengthen kind of your, and going back to executive function, right? Your working memory, your inhibition, impulse, and cognitive flexibility.
Of course. So those are the three main pillars, I would say, of executive functioning. And the rest of the pieces, they all stem from those three. And when we talk about working memory, it's twofold. There's a verbal part and a nonverbal part, which is a visual spatial component. And I always say that when in play, I can see all the strengths and all of the challenges. Let's say a really great example, you know, we could start younger when kids are building, whether it's any type of building material, let's say it's a magnet tile, and the struggle of holding that piece and knowing how to turn it so that the rest of the magnets don't fall, that's an executive function skill. To be able to then, like, because what we're asking them to do is turn it in their mind and then turn it physically. And you, I can see the struggle, and then you hear the struggle. You hear kids grunting, you hear them sighing, you hear, I'm gonna say, you hear them farting. Because like they, there's a, and parents excuse themselves. They go, I'm so sorry. And I let them know that it happens all the time. They go, why? And they say, well, because the gut and the brain are connected. That's a different conversation. And it's like such, it's also a release because they are working so hard to figure out how pieces fit together that it takes all of their effort. So when you imagine this magnet tower going up, right? Talk about like impulse inhibition, which leads into frustration tolerance. What happens when the whole thing crumbles? Do the magnets then go flying? Usually when I first start the work, I get blamed. And I get blamed because I'm the closest one there. And I also get blamed, and I had this conversation with a social worker, and I said, you're probably getting blamed for something that happened in this kindergartner's life. And she said, yeah. And I go, take it. And there was a pause on the phone. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, take the blame. Take the blame because you can carry it. And I usually take it and hold it. And I go, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize my body was that close. And it was such a different perspective because her initial reaction was to say to me, but it wasn't my fault. I go, right, that's your rational brain. I know it wasn't your fault. Of course you know it wasn't your fault. I said, this five-year-old is living in a completely different part of his brain. And I know it sounds irrational to you, and to him, it's very real. So when you attempt to come from a rational side, he's not going to hear you because he can't. He can't. That's not the place where he is. And that's where play comes in. Like all of the struggles and all of the intricacies that kids really don't have the opportunity to work through during the day, they all come out. And I tell parents also, I said, family secrets also come out in play. So I'm just going to let you know that it's all, there's, we don't hold boundaries. It all comes out. Like kids, I especially love when kids take on their parents' like tones of voice. And it usually becomes when we get into conflict in play, which I of course create, because what kind of play is without conflict? The resolution, interestingly enough, in the beginning, when we first start working together, is you're punished, go to your room. And then I pause. And if the parent is in the room, I look at the parent a little bit, and they're sitting there going like, I guess this is what happened at home. And sometimes, like, yes, sometimes the kids will say, like, well, then I'm going to spank you. And the parents are like, no, like we never hit them. We don't like, I don't know where this is coming from. And like, should we be concerned? And they say, well, this is in their minds, like, this is what needs to be worked through, because they're thinking that maybe this is how punishment is meant to be. And it either goes that way or it goes into isolation, which is the timeout mode.
There's so many little nuggets here that my brain is like, woo, where did we go in this conversation? But I think to highlight that it is very real, regulation or dysregulation, wherever that student is, to honor that, that is their perception, that's their reality, that is very real in that moment for a student. And I think that gives an adult something to build upon. Again, thinking they're not doing this on purpose. there's another reason, and being curious and asking why, and being committed to that, building that relationship component and that connectedness. And you can also see with the work that you're explaining how that does develop or help strengthen the executive function part of it. And then how do we deal with when things don't go our way, which then you can see build that trajectory for better success and handling life as it happens, whether that's in the classroom or the community or home, in terms of how to process and deal with that.
Totally. And for older kids, you can look at a strategic board game where pieces can get in your way. And depending on, and I always go back to the capacity piece, depending on each child's capacity, I'll either like purposely block them because I know that they can handle it. And that's the important other wording where kids start to understand what type of challenges they can handle and what type they can't just in that moment and for that day. It doesn't mean that when they say, I can't handle this today, that we're letting them get away with something. They know their nervous systems best. We can simply assume they know what's going on for them. And it's so important when a child comes in already distraught, whatever plan I had, that plan is done. That plan is done. And the approach is, today seems like a different kind of day. And the answer that I usually get is, yes, like either school sucked, something was hard, something, maybe something just happened. They got off the bus, something didn't work out. And it's never about that one thing. And that's what I want to be really clear on for parents, for educators alike. It's never about that one thing. It may look like it's about that one thing because that's the straw that broke the camel's back. I guarantee you there were others. There were others along the way throughout the day that the kids handled. And this was just the tipping point. And that's the reason that what we want to do is, well, we don't want to minimize it. Right. And that's something that parents have said, well, it's just such a small thing. Like he's done it before. And I said, yes, when he was regulated. Absolutely. Absolutely. He has done it before. In this moment, this one little thing is the biggest challenge that your child has ever had to overcome. And again, it comes back to that's where we meet him. That's where play comes in. That's where the co-regulation part comes in, and we meet the struggle. And the other part is we meet the struggle and we don't fix it.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is hard as a parent, right? Because you oftentimes want to jump in and protect your baby. And so I think that is hard for a parent to have to pause and learn those skills that you're also teaching a student or a kiddo. Absolutely. Let me ask you about dopamine. Okay. And so as we were talking about building and play, kind of that's that slow dopamine release, right? With those wins. How do you find that experience in terms of coming from a generation of a lot of kiddos on a device and getting those quick hits of dopamine?
It's not the same. It's not the same because a device does it all for you. When you go into, a lot of my kids are into Minecraft, let's say, or any other type of building scene, with a click of a button or a press of a finger, the world is already built. It's yes, sure, there's a little bit of problem solving. It's not to the same extent. So your brain doesn't have to work as hard to gain like the same rush, let's say. And then we slow things down in play and it becomes, this is taking too long. This is boring. When are we going to be done? I don't know what else to do. And I'm so glad that sometimes it comes out with language. Other times it comes out in very different ways. And then the parents look in confusion and they go, well, they were just having fun. What happened? I said, well, first of all, that's your version of fun. Excitement is also dysregulatory. And what happened was that the idea was lost. It was there that we were working through it. And then it got to the point that it was too challenging and the brain went no way. And the child either pulled back or I've had kids run.
Yeah.
They go, I'm done. I'm done with this idea. See ya. Put it away. I'm not doing this anymore. And then you have to figure out, well, what's the response? And the response, my response usually is, oh, I hear you. Always. What you're letting me know is that the idea is done. Yes, it's done. Put it away. Okay. I'm looking at it as we're still figuring it out. And then here comes that play challenge of, do you have a little bit more in you? Like, let's see. can we dance a little bit in this discomfort and like see what we can figure out? And it's just, it is individualized and you have to get to know the child to see how much you can push a little bit and when to pull back. And, you know, we all have those days. I've had them too, where I'm thinking, okay, they're open to the challenge, like just a little bit more, just a little bit more. And then that just a little bit more sends them over the edge. And I go, my bad. that was all me. And parents who know me well, I'm thinking of like a dad in particular, he'll go, what did you do to her at the end? And I said, it was me. I thought that we were in it and it was just too much. It's on me. We're regulated now. We're back. I take full responsibility. I did it.
But you bring up an excellent point about just right challenge, whether you're a parent or a professional, and building that capacity for a student. And it is very individualized and it can change from day to day, but having our students be able to kind of feel a little bit of that discomfort and then be able to problem solve within and pivot in one way or the other, and being able to just, again, kind of looking at that big picture, little picture of where can I push, right? And as an educator, would do the same thing, right? Like, how far can I get? I don't want you frustrated and overwhelmed, but I do want to kind of kiss the edge of that so I can, you know, start to build some skills.
And that's where those skills are built. It's the skills. They're built in that just right zone of discomfort, a little bit more. How much support can I provide? Because it really comes down to the skill building. And when kids are struggling, it's not because they want to. No child wants to struggle every single day.
No adult wants to.
None of us do. There's a skill deficit somewhere. And when we dig deep enough, we can find it. And those are the executive function skills are foundational. There's a skill deficit somewhere along the line in a combination of the skills. And when you find it and you know what it looks like, you have this aha moment. And then you go, well, now what? Now that I know it's there, what do I do now? And sometimes you have to work backwards.
Yeah. And sometimes it takes a little bit, right? And especially if you're creating plans for kiddos in the school to really be able to understand some of the what's triggering a student, what's really going on, and really emphasizing here in our moment today, that collaboration and communication piece for parents and professionals so that nobody feels like they're operating in a silo, that they feel like, okay, we're really supporting a student holistically, which kind of brings me into the whole brain integration as well. And so how does that help students connect with others? And also, I think about theory of mind as well.
I mean, absolutely. So theory of mind is more top down. It's another higher level executive function skill because it allows you to understand that you have certain thoughts and the thoughts of someone else are separate from yours. And it goes back to, well, how do we teach that? In play with ideas. Oh, my idea is actually different from your idea. Your idea is to, we do a lot of, my characters get trapped and I go to jail. So I go, oh, all the time. Your idea is to trap my guys. I go, the thing is, my guys, they're really sneaky. Their idea is that they're going to find a way to break out. I go, just to let you know, you can trap them. They have a very different idea. And then you build recognition of like, what kind of plan can we make? Where do we go from here? So whole brain integration is also about understanding that the brain develops from bottom up, and it's also integrated from left to right. And all pieces have to come together. I think oftentimes we hear just the difference between, you know, like what's bottom up processing, and that's your nervous system reacting, because there's no thinking involved. It's not, you haven't reached that higher level, because that's not where the brain is. It was designed specifically for self-protection. Like, we are all, the brain is narcissistic. Like, it is. It wants to protect us all the time. And then, you know, how great is that? Because without it, we would be like walking into the street. The brain is designed to do that. And when we recognize it in that way and go, oh, this is a self-protection mode. In some kids, it looks different. Some will shut down. Some will blurt things out. Some will completely run away from a challenge. Some kids will yes you. The yesers, I would say, like, that's another, that's a fear response. And the brain just wants to, just tells you, like, just, like, people please. The people pleasers, the yesers, that's coming from fear. It's not because they actually want to do that thing. It's a fear response. And oftentimes it's overlooked. So when you look at the brain as developing as layers, what's important to know is that the brain always prefers its previous layer. It's called the fallback method. So it's like literally when we are overstressed and overwhelmed and there's too much on the nervous system, the brain will like fall back to its previous, what it previously knows. So when you talked about skills being online or offline, we can look at it that way. So when there is overstimulation in the environment, and for every brain, that overstimulation is different. Okay. The brain starts to slowly conserve energy. It's like your phone when you want it to go into like energy conserving mode because you're going to run out of battery. The human body does the same thing. It starts to conserve energy, and we don't want to like have to start thinking about all of these plans and like what we're supposed to do on the playground. We want to conserve as much energy as possible, which means sometimes then we're going to react based on emotions. Sometimes we're going to then like react based on fear, which is the earliest way that we've learned. And what happens is when we look at it as a, going back to how we started the conversation, when we look at it as a misbehavior, we're missing an opportunity, and we're missing an opportunity to build a relationship and to show the other nervous system that this environment is a safe place for you. Like, what does that word even mean? It's a feeling. It's a sensation. It's knowing that no matter how you show up, somebody's going to be there to support you and comfort you instead of sending you to timeout.
So we know this, there's not a one size fits all for our kiddos, and key to customize our approach. So what can you recommend for parents or professionals that are hearing this information? They may be thinking of a student or their particular child and say, oh, okay, now I'm seeing this. What would you recommend as like next steps? What will we do first to kind of start this path of understanding?
Start looking at the world from your child's perspective. And that's going to be the most challenging. And I would say it's the most rewarding thing that you'd be able to do. Like, look at the problem the way that when you're in a classroom, the way that your student views it. Like, get into the mind of that child, and they will, I am certain of it, they will lead you. So then you going, oh, that's what happened for you. That's the way you experienced it. Oh my gosh, now I know exactly what to do for next time. As the adult, it's up to us to, again, in the beginning, be the kids' executive functioners. And that's sometimes the hardest part of the work, is to put all of the pieces together really as quickly as possible, and then like wrap it up as a gift, all integrated. And then you give it to the child and you go, here, I've figured it out. And this is what's going to help you. And then I'm going to teach you how to do it on your own, really slowly. And that's what I hope that gets integrated into IEPs also. Like, executive function skills need to be part of goals, because that's, in order to be goal-oriented, in order for a student to think of a goal and attain it, that's an executive function skill. And that goal needs to be important to them. I think that's the other part when you're talking about next steps, right? When you're looking at something as individualized as a program for education for a child, is, okay, these are goals that are relevant and important to who?
Bingo.
Like, who are these for, really?
And as a parent, thinking about my next question is going to be a question about navigating IEPs, but I think the element you just said is really key in terms of when you receive a draft of your IEP and you see written goals, kind of asking those questions. And then when, as a parent, going to write your parent input statement for that IEP, thinking about, you know, I always say prioritize, but then also seeing and asking, and that's the really critical part of our kiddos being part of the IEP process, so that they can have that autonomy and say, you know what, this is really hard for me, and this works really well for me, and this does not work really well for me, which I do recognize is a process getting a student to that point to be able to communicate those things. But it's such a gift for that student to be able to then start to advocate for what they need.
And exactly, we can get kids there. We can get them to actually want to participate, because that's where the ownership part comes in. I know I mentioned it before, then they want ownership in their own learning, because we've given it to them all along. We go, yes, this is for you. You're coming here to figure out what works. And sometimes we're going to test it out and it doesn't work. We're going to figure out what worked for you and what didn't. And when I phrase it that way in the beginning, sometimes with my older kids, they don't know what that means. And I said, well, you're telling me that the day was bad. I'm hearing that something worked out for you and then something didn't work out. What's the part that didn't work out? Because then they group it all together and everything is bad.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I like teasing it out that way for a student. Or, you know, I'll say, what does bad look like to you? Or if, you know, a kid will say, my day was fine. Well, what does fine look like? What does good look like?
The hardest part is that they go, well, bad means not good. They said, oh, that's interesting. And what's not good? Well, it's just bad. What is that? And then I say, well, what else happened? Because then we're going to be stuck in this back and forth. And I say, all right, well, let's table that word for a moment. Help me figure out what actually happened. So what I'm doing is I'm taking the emotion part out of it. And I want them just to be the narrator. Walk me through what happened. Like, what was this scenario like?
In a non-judgment way.
Absolutely, in a non-judgment way. And for some of my, I would say, socially, emotionally younger kids, because I'm not looking always at chronological age, the ones who are socially, emotionally younger, they need figures. They need to be able to embody something else to go, okay, so this is this kid who is bothering me. This is me, and this is someone else. And then we have this whole scene that plays out. And in that scene, something eventually gets resolved. Or, which is also a really great part, it doesn't get resolved. And then I say, sometimes when there are problems, there is no solution. And then we go back to the discomfort where kids tell me, just give me the answer. Just give me the answer and make it go away. So then I say, well, which part? Because it sounds like then you want the whole day to disappear and it's here. This is the unknown. This is where we're going to live for a little bit. I don't like it. I hear you. I hear that you don't like it. I don't really like it either. And this is what we have. This is that that discomfort is rough. It is the hardest thing, like you said, for kids and grown-ups alike. We all want answers. We all want to know because that's what soothes our brain. from a young age to an old age, we all want to know. It's like if I were calling a friend and say, let's meet for coffee. And she'll say, well, when? And I go, I don't know. I'm just going to think about it. She'll go, well, I need to know. What do you mean? I need to know. Of course you need to know because your brain needs to know because then it's relying on something secure and safe. And then it feels anchored. And then a need is met. And when we go back to the behavior component, when you see a behavior on the outside, there's always an unmet need. And it's, you know, our role as adults to figure out what that need is. Because once you meet the need, there's going to be no need for the behavior because the need is met.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 100% in identifying where the lagging skills are or that unmet need so that we can then develop skills to better support and for that student to have those skills. So as we're winding down, so for parents that are navigating an IEP, how can they advocate for a dynamic, evolving support system within that IEP versus a one and done kind of approach?
That's the hard question.
That is the hard question. That was the $1 million question.
It is. It would be education from the parents' perspective also, like gathering, you know, a substantial amount of evidence that's parent friendly to say, I've done some digging and this is the background of my child. And the thing is, let's say for ADHD, the thing is like the ADHD brain learns in a different way. That is undeniable. Right? The autistic brain learns in a different way, also undeniable. And what I'm looking at, right, as a parent, what I'm looking at is something that doesn't quite fit where my child is today. And of course, parents want to be appreciative and they say, I'm so glad that you want to design this IEP for my child needs. We're all here for the same thing. And then it disarms the professionals a little bit. And then the parent would say, because we're all here for the same thing, I'm just letting you know what has been working. So now how can we take what has been working and then go ahead, put fancy language and words to it so that it is in this document that's mandated. And it's really about the parent having also that confidence to let the team know that this is where my child is. I understand this is where you want them to be. And they're not there yet. They're not there yet because the goals are set too high. The expectations are set too high. We all want kids to be successful. So let's show them what success looks like. Let's show the child what success looks like. Let's show the parent what success looks like. Because then when kids know that they're successful, then they want to set another challenge. They want something a little bit harder. And it works because kids have told me this, like, give me something harder. This is too easy. And in my mind, I'm thinking 6 months ago, it was not. And it's not like I'm going to tell them, well, this is not appropriate. Or like, how could you tell me that, you know, this is too easy. I'm going to say, oh my gosh, like you figured out that another challenge was meant for today. Let's see. Let's take on another challenge. Let's see how it works out. And like they approach it in such a way where it's not just confidence, it's also their self-esteem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's why it's really important. And when I'm doing IEP coaching with parents, to talk about and teach parents how to collect data, so to say, on their kiddo. So they're building that evidence for the team and looking at what are their reactions at home and in the community for what they're working on, what their needs are, and then being able to, you know, whether you're doing a digital kind of notebook or a physical notebook, or taking pictures or little videos of whether, you know, what the frustration looked like. And it can be tied to an academic, but it doesn't have to be tied to an academic. We know that it's educational impact when we talk about IEPs. So teaching parents so that they can then have that bandwidth to say what you just eloquently laid out to help build and bolster that IEP that truly does align for that student. So as we kind of wind down, what was something I didn't ask that I didn't know enough to ask that I should have asked?
Oh my gosh, I love these questions.
I mean, I feel like we could talk.
We can.
More
we
hours,
can.
For sure.
You know, we touched on the importance of theory of mind, which I think is really valuable. I feel like going deeper into what burnout looks like for the autistic brain and for the ADHD brain is something that's really valuable and really important. And also understanding that when it comes to autism, and I'm going to say, like, let's pick on the autism piece for a moment, there is something called the double empathy problem, which is a disconnect between a neurotypical brain and an autistic brain. And that's where sometimes people will say, like, oh, they lack empathy. And that's from your perspective. Like, oh, rigidity means that they're not empathic. And I go, well, rigidity means that that's safety in their environment. It doesn't mean that there's a lack of empathy. I think that's something that needs to be talked more about. And when it comes to ADHD, the importance of movement. I mean, for autism also, and like the importance of movement and how regulating movement is, like what that means, how to look at play from all different perspectives. Because when kids in play say that they don't want to build, to me, it's, oh, there's a motor planning challenge here. There's a coordination difficulty here. You don't want to do that because you can't. And it impacts their social interactions. I think that's the one part that I would say we didn't have enough time to touch on, like what social interactions actually are, because they have nothing to do with turn taking and they have everything to do with executive functioning.
I feel like we need a part two.
Just on social interactions, we could talk the entire time on what it takes to have a conversation and what it means to have a back and forth peer-to-peer conversation, and also, you know, peer to adult, which goes into adult to adult. And I'm going to leave off saying this, that most conflicts usually happen because people are having two different conversations.
Oof. Yeah. Yes. Wow. So much fantastic information. And you're right. I love these other elements that we certainly need to talk more about to help both parents and professionals take a better understanding so that we can then move and do better in what we're doing in our paths of supporting vulnerable kiddos. So how can people find you?
I am at Play to Learn Consulting on social media, and my website is also the same. It's playtolearnconsulting.com. You can sign up for my newsletter. You can receive other tidbits in your email inbox. I think for parents and professionals alike, it's helpful. I also speak professionally, and that's constantly updated on my website. You know, I could talk about executive function skills, and I do for 6 hours at a time. So if anybody ever wants more information, I have those coming up as well.
Excellent. Excellent. And I'll put all those links in our show note as well. So what a pleasure to connect with you today and have this conversation. And I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
You bet. All right. Bye for now. Thanks for tuning in to the Special Ed Strategist. Remember, the right support can make all the difference. As your dedicated Special Ed Strategist, I'm here to guide, collaborate, and empower your kiddos' success. Keep igniting potential one step at a time. Until next time, take care and keep strategizing. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com.